I'm going to talk about some genomics approaches too, but they're very targeted to one particular molecule, which is lignin. That's something that's close to my heart. 2 years ago, I didn't even know anything about bioenergy. We've been working on lignin for a long time, and we've kind of gotten sucked into the bioenergy story for obvious reasons, as you will see. So I think Steve's already covered this very nicely about the kinds of issues associated with this 30% replacement of transportation fuels with ethanol. We're going to need very, very large acreages, obviously. There's going to be a whole pile of issues that are associated with this: disease, ecological, and sustainability issues associated with potentially the growth of monocultures, which is what we're going to probably have, of novel dedicated bioenergy crops. Issues of waterizer and fertilizer requirements, transportation issues, and of course, the thing that I'm particularly interested in is the processing efficiency, and it's critically important to improve that efficiency at all stages of the biofuel process. But we can certainly improve biomass. That may not be enough. We have to be able to get more sugar out of cell walls than we currently can. And genomic approaches are going to be valuable for addressing many of these issues. And we have whole genomes now for, as you know, Arabidopsis, poplar, rice, Medicargo coming up soon, lotus, foxtail millet coming up soon, which is going to be probably a good model for switchgrass, and the various other initiatives that are now ongoing with JGI. Some of these may be whole genomes, some of these may be massive EST sequencing. I'm sure I'm preaching to the choir here. As you know, there are three processes associated with bioethanol conversion: a pretreatment process to increase the accessibility of cellulose and to solubilize hemicellulosic sugars, and this usually involves warm acid treatment, and then hydrolysis of that biomass to produce sugars, and this is usually enzymatic with cellulases and cellobiases, and then fermentation of the sugars to ethanol. And the cell wall polymer lignin, which is a major feature of secondarily thickened plant cell walls, is really the part of the lignocellulosic material that just screws up our attempts to get to those sugars. And it's been known for a long time that lignin negatively impacts a number of biomass utilization processes. For example, paper pulping from trees, digestion of forages by ruminant animals, and particularly fermentation of biomass to biofuels. And you can see here that with the cellulose microfibrils, the hemicellulose molecules joining these things together, and then there are very strong associations between lignin and hemicellulose. Lignin is an insoluble polymer, and it essentially prevents accessibility of enzymes to the cellulose microfibrils. The acid pretreatment breaks this up somewhat, but it doesn't fully make the cellulose freely available. Now, the structure of lignin is a great story, and right now there's a lot of debate about it, and the answer is we don't really know the structure of lignin. We know the monomeric units in lignin. They are these monolignol C6C3 units that exist in various flavors. Here you can see what's called a syringyl or S unit, which has two methyl groups. Here you can see a guaiacyl or G unit, which has one methyl group. Not shown on here is a hydroxyphenyl unit, which wouldn't even have this methyl group here, and is just the aromatic ring just simply has one hydroxyl. And these are the three units that are polymerized fairly randomly by free radical coupling to give lignin. And in this old model of beech lignin from 74, it's shown as a really complex chicken wire kind of structure. More recent studies suggest that maybe it's more linear. And these are some models from John Ralph, actually, for some of the lignin from some of our transgenic plants. And you can see this structure looks a little simpler. The lignin is in change with maybe a more limited number of different types of side branches. And we're not sure which of these is correct. I would veer towards the one on the right, but we still don't really know. What we do know is that lignin acts as a physical and structural barrier inhibiting the degradation of polysaccharides. And most of the lignin in the cell walls of grasses is linked covalently with polysaccharides. The extent of cross-linking has a marked influence on the wall properties. And to make it worse, when we do get rid of the lignin, if we do chemical treatments to remove lignin, then some of the breakdown products of the lignin themselves are inhibitors of the fermentation process for making ethanol, as are breakdown products of the hemicelluloses, furfural sugars and things like this. So the more you have to do pretreatment to break down lignin, the more you generate inhibitors of subsequent fermentation. So it would be fantastic if you could have plants that had no lignin and stood up perfectly and were processable, which of course we can't. We are somewhat unusual in using alfalfa as a model species, and there's a historical reason for this. A lot of our lignin biosynthesis and modification work has been targeted towards improving alfalfa as a forage crop. And what we have done is improved alfalfa so that it can go into a bioreactor, namely a rumen, where it can be attacked by cellulolytic microorganisms, and that cellulose can be broken down to sugars and then further metabolized. That's not that different from a biorefinery. So alfalfa is a perennial nitrogen-fixing plant. Steve showed those yields up to about 8 tons per acre, whatever. It's definitely less than the grasses. But it does fix nitrogen, and that could be quite important when we look at sustainability. So even if alfalfa may not be solely a dedicated bioenergy crop, it may be a player, perhaps in intercropping. There are some great genomics resources now for the closely related model legume Medicago truncatula, whose whole sequence will be completed next year, and from which some of my colleagues at the Nobel Foundation have now generated really, really nice transposon insertion and fast deletion resources so that we can do reverse genetics in Medicago now nearly as simply as you can in Arabidopsis. So it's actually a really nice genetic model. We know a lot about lignin and its relationships to forage digestibility. And as a potential bioenergy crop, alfalfa also, I think, has potential for co-products. Of course, the leaf is very, very rich in protein. And maybe if you're going to ferment the stems, you could have a value-added product from the rest of the plant. So our strategy is based on the fact that we know, or we think we know, all the various steps in the biosynthetic pathway leading to lignin in Medicago truncatula, that's our model. The beauty of Medicago truncatula as a model species is that it's incredibly closely related to alfalfa. So probably 50% of the orthologous genes are close to 100% identical in their open reading frames. So we can find all the lignin pathway genes in Medicago truncatula. We can clone those open reading frames, and we can transform them straight into alfalfa, sense or antisense. And the sequences are similar enough to give you the knockdowns that you need. We regenerate the plants, confirm that we've downregulated the transgene, and then we work on the analysis of the lignin properties, lignocellulose digestion, phenotypic and agronomic analysis of the plants. And that's kind of summarized here just for one gene. So this is the supposed biosynthetic pathway to the monolignols. Starts off with the amino acid phenylalanine. You basically go along here to introduce one hydroxyl, and then you modify the side chain to make an alcohol from what is up here, an acid. So all you do along here really is alter the side chain to make an alcohol. You then introduce some more functional groups, another OH and another methyl, and this then is converted to the alcohol to give you the G lignin units. Then you introduce another hydroxyl here and another methyl there to give you the S units. It's a fairly simple pathway. And over the past many years, our group and other groups like Clint Chappell, for instance, Vincent Chang, have identified all the genes involved in these various interconversions. And based on genomics types approaches, we can go in and see that there might be a whole number of TCs, tensitive consensus sequences, annotated as these genes in the database. We can do in silico analysis to see which tissues they're expressed in. These are just lots of different tissues. Pull out the ones that are highly expressed in stems. These tend to be the ones involved in lignin. And if we then downregulate, say, this particular gene here, we get very, very strong lignin phenotypes. So we've been successful in modifying the lignin pathway at every stage in this biosynthetic scheme here. And this just shows you a little bit about what some of these plants look like. Lignin is kind of easy to look at, because it has autofluorescence. If you look at it in color, you can see as you go from the first to the ninth internode in this alfalfa stem, you can see the increasing autofluorescence due to the increased lignification. So this is why in an alfalfa field, as it gets older, the quality goes down. The stems are becoming more and more lignified. This shows you now, I think, the fifth internode in transgenic plants downregulated independently at every step in the lignin pathway as we go through the pathway, starting with phenylalanine all the way through. And this is the control. And what you can see pretty clearly is that certainly the earlier you hit the pathway, the bigger effect you have on the amount of lignin fluorescence, which is what you would expect. But it's not just lignin content that you change when you do this. You also modify lignin quality. This is just another example of this using something called Maurer staining. And Maurer staining is a reaction that's pretty specific for the S lignin, the dimethylated syringyl lignins. And they give this pinkish red color. So you can see in some of these lines, particularly the HCT line here, somewhere there's a comp line here, that red has changed to a dirty brown, and these plants contain virtually no S lignin at all. So not only can we reduce, we can reduce the amount of lignin, we can alter its composition. I'll tell you a little bit more towards the end of the talk about the fact that all these vascular tissues don't look to be the same shape either. And we're obviously doing more than just affecting chemistry here. If we, there are methods we can use to measure lignin composition much more accurately than just staining. There are chemical methods like phyoacidolysis, for example, which will at least partially degrade that lignin and then allow you to separate out by GCMS the different monomers, the H, G, and S units. And doing that, what we can see is if we take plants, if we take plants that are just looking at total lignin for a start, from the first internode to the eighth here, you can see this is the normal pattern of lignin deposition. In our transgenic plants, the lignin production is decreased in pretty much all of these, but it still keeps on increasing with development. That's an important point. These plants haven't just been stopped at an early developmental stage. They keep on developing, but they keep on making less lignin or wrong lignin as a function of time. And this more complicated diagram down here shows the lignin compositions, the H, the G, and the S units. And you can see there are some big differences. But a major thing, just to summarize, is that if you take out COMT here, for example, the S lignin, which I think is this blue one, light blue one here, has virtually gone completely. If you downregulate HCT or C3H, two of the very early enzymes in the pathway, the amount of H lignin is increased hugely. Now remember, H is the first one to be formed, so if you're blocking it so you make no G or S, you're going to accumulate more H. I could tell you a lot more about the details of this, but the bottom line is that what we have in this population of plants, that in which ultimately we've targeted 10 different transgenes, and we have lots of multiple independent lines for each of the transgenes, we have a population of alfalfa plants with varying amounts of lignin and varying compositions of lignin, which enable us to look at the relationships between lignin content, composition, and processing ability of the lignocellulosic biomass. So one of the first things we did was get Srinu Reddy here to stick this alfalfa forage from all these different plant lines into fistulated steers and measure the in rumen digestibility. So I don't know why the guy's smiling, but and what came out of that was probably not surprising. The controls are the wild-type plants, which are shown down here, this group of plants here. And this shows the fact that as we downregulate some of these genes, particularly some of the earlier ones like C3H and C4H, we get a very large increase in situ digestibility in the rumen. And if we plot now the lignin content of these different lines as acid detergent lignin against in situ digestibility, there's a very, very strong relationship, inverse relationship, between the amount of lignin in these lines and the digestibility. And there's very little relationship between the main structural parameter, the S over G ratio, that's the dimethylated to the monomethylated, and lignin and digestibility. Now, in some species, that may not be the case. And for paper pulping, the S over G ratio is critical. In this case, it doesn't seem to be so important. So that kind of got us then interested in a solicitation from the DOE for one of their bioenergy feedstocks grants, and we said, why don't we look at this material in relation to saccharification for bioethanol? So basically, we take our alfalfa biomass from all these different transgenic lines, and we powder it, dry it, clean up the cell wall residues, and then we treat with dilute sulfuric acid. This is acid pretreatment. And if we do that, what we see is that in several of the lines, there is a small but statistically significant increase in the ability to release sugars from the cell wall in these transgenic plants. Now remember now, this is relatively harsh chemical treatment. It's not too subtle. And we're still releasing a little more sugar. If then we take stuff that's been pre-treated, and then that residue is treated with cellulase, so this would be the next step in your saccharification, cellulase plus cellobiase, now we see these differences get even bigger. And we're almost doubling the amounts of sugar that we can release per unit of biomass from these materials. What's more interesting is if we can actually take material now and treat it directly with cellulase without any pretreatment at all, and the pretreatment is costly and potentially polluting and something you'd like to get rid of, and you can see very large differences now in the amount of sugar that's released from some of these transgenic lines without even doing a pretreatment. If you don't have to do acid pretreatment, you might be able to express enzymes in your plant tissue that could actually start the degradation process immediately after harvest. So this was really quite exciting to us. The sort of sugars you're seeing released, this is the quality of the sugars now, not just the quantity, are what you would predict. So from the acid pretreatment step, you'll see we're releasing arabinose, xylose, a little bit of mannose, some glucose, some galactose. But you see xylose here is the main sugar that's released from all these different transgenic lines, meaning that we're releasing hemicellulose from these cell walls by acid. And then when we've done that and we go back and do the cellulase treatment, the major sugar that's released again is now glucose, indicating that we really are increasing the ability to break down the cellulose in this material. So, and this just shows you again what I mentioned about the pretreatment. What you can see here are control lines that have been pretreated with acid and then undergo enzymatic hydrolysis. And these are some of these transgenic lines that haven't been treated at all and undergo enzymatic hydrolysis, and we're getting significantly more sugar out of them. So this sounds really nice, that if we can modify lignin, we should be able to get, we may be able to double the ability to release sugar. Now, of course, that's the good news. The bad news is that these plants aren't quite as happy as a wild-type plant, and I want to just concentrate a bit on that as we go on. Oh, this just shows you the same sort of relationships as I showed you before for digestion in the rumen, suggesting that for both the acid pretreatment and the enzymatic treatment, there's a reasonably good, strong, negative, inverse relationship between the lignin amount and the saccharification efficiency. You can actually add some lignin composition terms to these regression equations and tighten them up even more. So there probably is a some impact of composition too, but it looks like it's primarily lignin amount that's important here. In alfalfa, I wouldn't want to extrapolate beyond that. Okay, so that was the good news. So now let's show you some bad news. A lot of these plants have growth phenotypes if you downregulate lignin. Not all of them. So these are some. This is a control here, and these are some C3H downregulated lines. They're not the most strongly C3H downregulated lines. They have nicely increased sugar release, and they look normal. But the ones that have the very best sugar release, you see there's a yield depression. And if you go through these, basically the Compt and the C-Compt plants are pretty normal, and I'll talk about these a little later as these have been commercialized for forage crops. CCR reduced. These are the ones that really give you the improved sugar production. And I'm going to show you some worst case scenario sort of horror photos now to show you how bad some of these plants can look. This is HCT. And you can see from looking at this slide here, these are some controls, and these are some HCT downregulated lines, and they look horrible. The biomass yield isn't as bad as its drop, isn't as bad as it looks, actually. It gets down at worst to about 40% because these plants are more branched than these. Okay. But you can see by looking at the vascular tissue here that these vascular elements here are very severely deformed in these HCT transgenic lines. And a number of the plants have delayed flowering, which may not in itself be a bad thing. So this is the controls here, and these ones here have somewhat delayed flowering. This just shows you CCR downregulated plants, and it's very interesting that in these plants the vascular elements are much larger than in wild type plants. And if we look in the cell walls, we can see these small pits beginning to appear between the between the different vascular tissues. This is another interesting one. If we downregulate COMT itself, these plants are pretty much okay. And the plants have good agronomic yield as well, as do plants where we downregulate C-COMT. And this is showing the S-lignin here. There's more S-lignin here than here. If we take plants in which we've downregulated them both, the plants are very unhappy. And you see these cell walls which are now puffy. We don't understand exactly what's going on there. But, you know, it's certainly true that you cannot downregulate lignin without having some negative impact. So we have to work out what's going on and see if we can engineer around it. This just shows you some effects on vascular cell size. So what Jin Nakashima did was to measure hundreds of independent cells in microscopic fields from plants downregulated in all these different transgenes, and showed that essentially the control size was about whatever these units are here. These are probably tens of microns. And the CCR, 1.5 times bigger, and the HCT, they're way small. So the point is, we don't actually understand why this is. It doesn't just correlate with lignin content. It's something to do with exactly where the lignin in the cell wall is being downregulated, maybe early on during the process. So why the HCT plants were interesting. These are the ones that give us the best saccharification efficiency, and they're the most, some of them are the most downregulated. You know, we can find plants which you could probably grow in the field and would give you more sugar per acre than a wild type plant, but some of them are bad. There's a paper came out in Plant Cell early this year, suggesting that the problem was due to flavonoids. And what this group showed was that the Arabidopsis plants that are knocked out in the HCT gene, a dwarf, and they seem to accumulate flavonoids. And it looks like the block in the lignin is causing spillover into the flavonoid pathway. And they then postulated that the flavonoids were inhibiting auxin transport, and that was why the plants were dwarf. So that sounds nice and simple. So what they did was they crossed the lignin downregulated plants into a line in which chalcone synthase was knocked out, which is the first enzyme of the flavonoid pathway. So these plants can't make flavonoids anymore. And now these plants grow normally and still have the reduced lignin. That sounded wonderful. So we thought, if that's it, you know, we don't necessarily want to get rid of all flavonoids, but we understand what's going on. We can engineer around it. But I won't go through the data here, but we've analyzed the flavonoids in all our alfalfa transgenic lines, downregulated in all these different transgenes, and we see no change in flavonoid patterns at all in any of these plants. So we don't think it's that. So what we're going to do, actually, is to now to do a fairly detailed microarray analysis of all these different alfalfa lines to try and see if we can see some gene signatures that are associated with the growth defects in those lines that have them, so we could maybe work around it. But the news isn't all bad. The plants downregulated in caffeic acid O-methyltransferase and caffeyl-alcoa O-methyltransferase are ones that we are currently working with Forage Genetics International to move forward for commercialization for improved digestibility alfalfa. And these plants have, you know, 15 to 20% improved saccharification efficiency, which is not insignificant. And these traits are perfectly stable in the field, and there appears to be no real problem agronomically. With one of these transgenes, there's a little bit of lodging. You can breed that out very easily just by moving it into a different genetic background. And this just shows you a field in Nampa, Idaho. From this line here to here are all caffeic acid OMT downregulated alfalfa. There's acres and acres of this stuff. It's been grown up for baling and then testing out in lactating dairy cows. And from this study and a number of others that have been done over the last several years, we can see that the lignin content, for example, of the nulls is 126 units here. In the COMT and the C-COMT downregulated, it's very significantly downregulated, and this reduction in lignin is absolutely stable in multiple years of field trials. So that's the good news. The downregulation improves the forage quality, it also improves saccharification, and it's a very stable trait expression. So we think this is useful. So in summary, reducing lignin content positively impacts forage digestibility and the chemical or enzymatic cell wall deconstruction. We think that lignin is probably a really major factor limiting cell wall deconstruction. I think there may be other things that you can do with playing around with cellulose, microcrystallinity, and other things, but lignin seems to us to be one of the really major factors. Theoretically, reducing or altering lignin could mean that you don't have to do acid pretreatment, and if that allows you to do bioprocess consolidation, that would be huge economically. Lignin modification is stable under field conditions, but modifying lignin content and composition can negatively impact plant growth, and it's not worth trying to pretend that it doesn't. It does, and we need to understand more about such relationships. But I'm relatively confident that if we understood why these plants have these growth impacts, we would be able to engineer around those, and that's obviously going to be the next several years' work. So I'd like to thank the people who've been involved in these studies. This has been funded by more recently by DOE, USDA Plant Feedstock Genomics Program. By Forage Genetics International and by the Samuel Roberts Noble Foundation. And the main players in my lab and the work that I showed you are Fang Chen, Rui Zhao, Gail Shadle, Lisa Jackson, and Jin Nakashima. And just to point out that the work that we've been doing on alfalfa, we're now beginning to, we've got sucked in truly now, so we're now moving a lot of this stuff into switchgrass. And the Noble Foundation is a part of the DOE Bioenergy Science Center team, one of the three big bioenergy centers that were recently funded. And you can see our collaborators here. And most of the work that's going to be going on at Noble is going to be in developing genomics tools for switchgrass, trying to get to switchgrass, so to get where we are in switchgrass to the same place as where we are in alfalfa in about a year, if we possibly can, to get all the lignin genes and get that sorted out, and to do some work on sustainability, nutrient recycling, etc., etc. So our collaborators are UT, Oak Ridge National Lab, who are coordinating the project, Complex Carbohydrate Research Center at University of Georgia, and NREL. Thank you.
I can allow one question, and then please hold the questions until the end of the session. One question? Yeah.
Do you want to comment on any of the challenges that you see moving into the next year?
Transformation is one of the main ones. Zhengyu Wang's group have got a number of the lignin genes already in. In antisense into switchgrass, but the plants have not been evaluated yet. But I think the transformation efficiency is a major problem. What we may do is very quickly pull out all the lignin pathway genes and use virus-induced gene silencing to knock out their orthologs in foxtail millet. That could be the first experiment. Switchgrass is going to take a while because of transformation.